And what's a wedding without champagne? Just the sound of a popping cork evokes a sense of celebration, and Chris Adams is here with his champagne recommendations for the summer season. He's the CEO of Sherry Lehman Wine and Spirits in New York City, and he joins us from our New York bureau. Chris, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Let's start with the budget list, the most bubbles for the buck, maybe things that aren't necessarily champagne.
Well, I think that if you're going to look at sparkling wines, you're going to look at regions that are known for producing great wines, but not necessarily within the region of Champagne. And those regions, sometimes within France, in the case of the Cremant that we're talking about today, Loire-Boyau, the Rosé, but they also exist in Spain with Cavas, and they certainly exist in Italy with Prosecco, and in California with the great sparkling wines of California.
All right, well, let's taste one of these. There's one here with a lovely pink label.
There
I think
is.
You mentioned it. Say it again.
It's Louis Boyau's Cremant de Bourgogne, I should say, the rosé, which, you know, it chose a pink wine because I thought, well, we're not going to taste one today from Champagne, where rosés are, you know, not prohibitively expensive, but they get more expensive. And I thought this was a nice opportunity to taste a delicious rosé, certainly value-priced at about $14 a bottle. And the first thing is I always point about when I look at a glass of wine, I always look at the color, of course. And here you have a sort of a pale salmon color. And importantly, and I think this is one of the things that you can talk about when you talk about sparkling wines versus champagne, is you want to always sort of take a look at the size of the bubbles. As sparkling wines get less expensive, one of the things that you often notice is the size of the bubbles get bigger.
Say that again. It's sort of the cheaper it is, the bigger
the
bubbles?
The less expensive it is, often it gets a little bit more carbonated. It gets
a little bit more like
seltzer
soda.
Water,
exactly. I did notice this is quite mild, and while there are a lot of bubbles, they are tiny.
They are very fine, exactly. And on the nose, strawberry, little black currant infused. And then most importantly, on the palate, shall we go ahead and taste? This is dry. This is fine. You don't want it to be cloying like a soda, where there's a sweetness that overwhelms everything. It's meant to go with light fare. It's meant to go with fruit. It's meant to go with salads. It's meant to be enjoyed in the summertime with that kind of fare.
Okay, and I see another bottle here, a rather oddly shaped bottle.
It is an oddly shaped bottle, more traditionally in the hundreds of years since shaped bottle of Domaine Ruinart. It's a beautiful bottle of champagne. It's a Blanc de Blanc, which in Champagne means that it's 100% Chardonnay. It is a little bit more expensive for sure, about $60 a bottle retail. But the great-grandson of the founder opened the doors to the American market and crossed the Atlantic way back in 1831 and introduced Domaine Ruinart to Andrew Jackson and the rest of the United States. So going into the 4th of July weekend, I thought this would be appropriate.
Okay, we're going to pour. So this is the drink of Andrew Jackson. This is a good selling point.
Right.
Very fizzy, almost like foam here.
It's going to relieve itself in a minute there.
This tastes very different.
It's a richer wine, for sure, so that the body of the Chardonnay comes through.
Now, what flavor should I be tasting here?
Well, you'll get a little bit of hint of hazelnut on the nose, for sure. A little bit of yeast, like a almost like a fresh bread kind of thing happening on the nose. And then candied citrus, maybe a little bit of herb, a little bit of ginger, but still very balanced and very bright. And when I say bright, you sort of get the acidity, you sort of get that sort of mouth-watering finish that comes through.
Now, what if we feel like splurging? What are the champagnes that are on your high-end list?
You know, right now, because we're still... It's still a challenging economy. Let's not kid ourselves. So when we talk about the top of the house champagnes, I'm still pretty conservative, and spending $200 or $300 a bottle on some of the wines that are out there still seems to me a little bit out of the realm of what is most appropriate. But there are some great champagnes out there that are more expensive, but that still deliver the tête de cuvée, or what I mean, the head of the house, the top of the house flavor and aromatic profiles, for relatively inexpensive price points. And the one that came to mind for me was the Pommery Cuvée Louise 1998. And that's about $110 to $120 a bottle you'll see at retail across the country. And 1998 was a very nice year. At this point, that wine has over a decade of aging. So it begins to take on some of the secondary and tertiary characteristics and aromatics. And that is a much more sublime experience and something that is a nice treat for the summer for sure.
Chris Adams is the CEO of Sherry Lehman Wine and Spirits in New York City. Chris, thank you so much for talking with us.
Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You can find a complete list of his champagne recommendations at our website, npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
More than 20,000 librarians from around the country are gathered this weekend here in Washington for the annual American Library Association Conference. And the main focus is funding. As usage increases, library funding is being cut in many cities. The librarians are meeting just across the street from here at NPR, and that makes our senior producer, Matt Martinez, just a little uncomfortable.
On August 23, 2005, I signed up for a library card at the main branch of the D.C. Public Library. I browsed the stacks for an hour or two and decided on a book, The Stardust Road by Hoagy Carmichael, his autobiography. I never took it back.
I knew that's where you were going.
Yeah. That's Camilla Alire, the president of the American Library Association. Since she's just across the street, I figured she might be able to help me out with this. I mean, she's the president of librarians, the pope of librarians. Is there any kind of absolution that librarians...
Well, let me tell you, first of all,
can give?
What they really want is they want the book back.
But that's way easier said than done. The compounded guilt of not returning this book is indescribable. When I pass it on my bookshelf, I cringe with embarrassment for myself. And of course, there are the library fees. D.C. Public Library policy states, for every day an adult book or CD is late, you will be charged 20 cents. That puts my bill at about $354. But lucky for me, Camilla Alire, she sees a way out.
Given your charm and your personality.
Oh, thank you.
And let me give you an inside name. Mm-hmm. Jenny Cooper.
Okay.
She's the director of the library.
Okay.
Tell her that you and I talked.
I will.
And I'm sure that she can help you with this.
Now, the great thing about confessing now is that all of the librarians are in the same place. So tracking down Jenny Cooper wasn't that hard.
What'd you do to this book? It's a mess.
No, it was like that when I first
got...
Yeah,
that's what they always say. Sure. I'm looking at a book here that is water damaged and that looks like it ought to be tossed just because it might get mold on all the rest of the books.
Personally, I don't think it looked that bad.
In this case, I'm not sure anybody else is ever going to check out this very old, very damaged book. But I'm happy to take it back from you.
No, you can take it from me?
Absolutely.
I don't have to take it back
we'll
to the library?
Oh,
wait, now, I feel a little bit of guilt. I can't just give it...
Feel free to feel guilt and expiate that in any way you want.
No library fees or anything.
No library fees or anything, but please don't spread it around. We're just glad to get the book back. Thank you so much.
So there it is. The Stardust Road by Hoagy Carmichael is back with the library, 5 years late. Even if they never return it to general circulation, I'm glad it's back nonetheless.
That's Matt Martinez, the senior producer of this program. And by the way, in exchange for their clemency, Matt's agreed to volunteer for the District of Columbia Public Library System.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. Leanne Hansen is on vacation. It's been more than 2 months since the blowout at BP's Deepwater Horizon well in the Gulf of Mexico. Cleanup of the oil has been ongoing ever since. And while oil has fouled beaches and marshes from Louisiana to Florida, most of it has not reached shore. Still, oil is not hard to find, even where cleanup efforts have been most intensive. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from New Orleans.
Barataria Bay is a wide expanse of shallow water on the southern Louisiana coast. It's a natural treasure filled with shrimp and fish and birds and mammals. In better days, Brent Bally would have a couple of sport fishermen on board his 23-foot skiff. On this day, under threatening skies, he's giving a group of journalists and officials from the National Wildlife Federation a tour, and he's not happy with what he's looking at.
Right now, very, very oily marsh. It's like quite nasty, disgusting, in fact. It's been just wave after wave of oil here for close to 2 months.
We see brown oil-saturated boom in front of marsh grasses looking like anaconda snakes. And as we motor on, it becomes clear the oil is not just on the shores of the marshes. We're on top of it. Sometimes it appears as an iridescent sheen, at other times reddish-brown spots. Despite all the skimming and boom laying, there is still a lot of oil in Barataria Bay. Yet there is also a lot of life. Alongside the boat, rising out of the oily water, a thrill, a pair of dolphins.
Oh, here he is, right here. There's two of them, a mom and a baby.
It's breathtaking to see them so close you can hear them breathe, yet heartbreaking at the same time. You want to tell them to get away from this oil, but of course they can't. There's no escaping it. A few miles further out on the bay, we reach Cat Island. It's not very big, a few acres, but it's jammed, packed with birds, mostly pelicans, some egrets, and a few roseate spoonbills. They're nesting, and if you look closely, you can see some of the baby pelicans. On the other side of the island, the scene is more disturbing. There are a number of clearly oiled birds.
The spoonbills in the bushes in there, all oiled up. A bunch of them in there. It's supposed to be pink.
The island is surrounded by two layers of booms, but they're full of oil and need to be replaced, according to Amanda Moore. She's a coastal Louisiana specialist with the National Wildlife Federation.
This boom should be maintained regularly. I mean, once it's oiled like this, it's useless.
Bally says the government should have built sand berms to fill in the breaks between the natural barrier islands to stop the oil from entering the bay much sooner. It's something the federal government only recently approved. On our way back, the weather clearing, we pass several small boats loaded with clean boom heading out into the bay. The people calling the shots about when and where the boom is replaced, along with countless other decisions, are at the Houma Incident Command Post. It's the heart of BP and the government's response to the oil spill along the Louisiana coast. Some 1,100 people work here now, many of them wearing color-coded vests, signifying their roles for colleagues they've never met before in a bureaucracy that was created almost overnight. I asked Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Chris Lee about all the oil-soaked boom we saw.
Our goal is to change that out as quick as it's soiled. But for several days in a row, we've been shut down for weather and lightning, that sort of thing.
The Coast Guard and BP say they've deployed more than 5 million feet of boom, along with hundreds of skimming vessels and barges. But despite all those resources, Lee admits that until the well is capped and no longer spewing tens of thousands of new barrels of oil every day into the Gulf, the cleanup is an uphill battle.
Until that source is secured, we have a growth business. We want to put ourselves out of business, but we can't do that until the source is secured.
There are any number of reasons why the cleanup hasn't accomplished more. Bad weather, government bureaucracy, reliance on technology such as skimmers and booms that has barely changed since the Exxon Valdez accident. And whenever the oil finally does stop gushing into the Gulf, it will take years, maybe generations, for places like Barataria Bay to recover. Brian Naylor, NPR News, New Orleans.
In Toronto, leaders from the G20 have been meeting all weekend where they've been talking about budgets and deficits. And NPR's Jim Zaroli is there and filed this report.
President Obama came to this summit hoping to persuade other leaders to pour money into government stimulus programs as a way of keeping the fragile recovery going. And though he had support from countries like Japan and Brazil, many others had different priorities. Instead of spending money on stimulus programs, European leaders want to attack what they see as a dangerous and growing pile of government debt. This morning, the summit's host, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, read a statement that attempted to paper over the differences. Harper said countries should spend stimulus money they've already committed to.
But at the same time, advanced countries must send a clear message that as our stimulus plans expire, we will focus on getting our fiscal houses in order.
The statement said wealthy countries should cut their budget deficits by 50% over the next 3 years. They should also try to stabilize the level of their debt relative to the size of their economies by 2016. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, says this is exactly the wrong thing to be doing right now. Baker says with the world economy recovering from a terrible recession, countries should be spending money, not cutting back.
But in any case, these are large reductions in deficits during a period when everyone expects we'll still be way below potential output. That's a big hit to these economies.
But deficit hawks held sway. Obama administration officials said they, too, wanted to cut the deficit. It was just a question of how quickly it should be done. As the talks went on at Toronto's convention center, downtown was gripped by violent demonstrations of a sort that are rare in this country. Throughout the weekend, protesters have swarmed streets, breaking windows and setting fire to police cars. Police said they have arrested more than 500 people. But the demonstrators have been unable to get near the summit site, which has been cordoned off. Rebecca Warren of Toronto came to protest all the money spent on the gathering.
They're blocking off at the city, and they're slowly but surely pushing us as far away from the G20 as they can. So the message to me is loud and clear. Be good citizens, sit at home, be passive, and don't disagree with your government. And that is not the kind of country that I thought I lived in.
Police also raided a university building, rounding up more protesters and housing them in a temporary detention facility. As world leaders tried to resolve their differences inside the convention center, many on the outside said they would be happy to see this summit end. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, Toronto.
Soccer's World Cup is now in the knockout phase, and one of the most surprising things is how well the South American teams are doing. Not the soccer powerhouses like Brazil and Argentina, but teams like Uruguay, Chile, and Paraguay, they've all made it to the round of 16. And Gideon Long, who's at the World Cup, reports on how South Africa is rapidly turning into a South American fiesta.
Chile's fans finally have something to shout about. After 48 years without winning a World Cup match, they've now won two in less than a week. That was enough to take them through the group stage of the competition, and they now face Brazil in an all-South American clash in Johannesburg tomorrow. The Chileans don't usually do well at the World Cup, but they came to South Africa full of confidence after an excellent qualifying campaign. Felipe Sutherland is a young fan who's made the journey to South Africa to follow the team.
If you see the qualifiers in South America, we finished second. So that is like, for us, very important. We won many matches outside our country. That was like not possible a few years ago, and today it's possible. So that reflects that we have a great team.
And the Chileans are not the only ones singing. Diego Maradona's Argentina are looking unbeatable with the man many consider the world's best player, Lionel Messi. Uruguay are unbeaten in their first four matches, and in Diego Forlan, they have one of the most dangerous forwards in the world. And even Paraguay, a nation of just 6 million people, have made it through to the last 16 after holding world champions Italy to a 1-1 draw. In all, of the 15 matches they've played here, the South American sides have lost just one. Chile's 2-1 defeat to European champion Spain on Friday. So why are the South Americans doing so well? Well, Argentine legend Diego Maradona came out with a theory this week. He said he thinks it's because they faced such a difficult task just to get here in the first place. And maybe he has a point. While the USA team played 10 matches to reach South Africa, the South Americans had to play 18 each. Good preparation for the month-long showdown of the World Cup itself. Ivan Zamorano went to the World Cup with Chile in 1998 and was one of the country's greatest ever players, scoring 34 goals in 69 appearances. He says the South American sides have really come of age at this World Cup.
They're having an impact. I think they've found an identity, a way of playing that offers something different. South American football is bringing a lot of quality to this World Cup. They're looking to play in a way that has something to do with the very identity of South American football.
That said, there are still plenty of ways other countries could spoil the South American party. But for now, it's the likes of Argentina and Brazil who are in charge here. And their fans, thousands of whom have made the long journey across the South Atlantic to be here, are enjoying every minute of it.
That's Gideon Long reporting from South Africa. Regular listeners will know we usually talk about books and music towards the end of the program, and the book we're about to feature shouldn't exist. Its author, Peter Stothard, was supposed to die of terminal cancer 10 years ago. Stothard is a well-known editor in London. He now heads up the Times Literary Supplement. But after he miraculously survived, he wanted nothing more than to forget about his struggle with cancer. But he couldn't. And while traveling in Italy, he began to compare his own battle with cancer to a war that took place over 2,000 years ago, a slave uprising that shook the Roman Empire to its core. Peter Stothard's new book is called Spartacus Road, and it mixes his personal battle with the battle led by the slave Spartacus.
I started writing it like a historical diary. But what I was actually writing on the Spartacus Road was my story of Spartacus, which I knew very well, but it was seen through this extraordinary filter of pain and chemical from about a decade before. And that's the unusual nature of this book, and that's the strangeness that many people have seen and appreciated in it.
In 73 BC, Spartacus and a small band of warriors take on a much larger contingent of Roman forces at Mount Vesuvius. Against impossible odds, you took that battle and relived it in your mind when you were being treated for cancer, almost as if that battle was happening inside of you.
Yes, somehow that story, which is a powerful, emotional, and evocative story in itself, it was almost as though I was seeing it in a kind of distorted bubble screen around me. It was very strange, and I can see why I wanted to forget about all that as soon as I went back to my proper job. But obviously I couldn't forget about it, and when I was on Mount Vesuvius, it came roaring back.
I just want to read a bit from that. You can almost picture those Roman soldiers and those slaves with their swords and shields. You write, "Inside of you there was an assault of iron on the upholstery of my stomach, ribs grasped like ladders, alien objects left behind, broken glass, blunt knives, wave upon wave of pain." And you can see that wave upon wave of soldiers attacking. And it's such an evocative image.
Yes, and in this particular case, I was writing about Roman history and telling the story of Spartacus in this way that I'd really never expected to do.
Because this book is sort of part memoir and part travelogue and part account of history, you obviously had a lot of time to think about what you went through. You had nicknamed your cancer Nero, who, of course, was the Roman emperor who killed his mother and several other family members, and is sort of regarded by ancient historians as tyrannical. And then you describe your cure as a miracle. How did it happen?
I was told that there was nothing they could do for me, that it couldn't be operated on, so they said they couldn't do anything about it. I went to Houston, Texas, found some clever scientific guys who said that possibly it was something they could do, very unpleasant, very painful. In fact, the drug was banned in Britain. But they said, "Well, you can give this a go if you like." And to everybody's amazement, it did work. The tumor started shrinking, and I survived. And now, 10 years on, and it's, as I say, somewhat surprising to me even to hear myself talking about it now. I thought it had gone. But I think what it teaches you is that these things that happen to you, you may think they've gone, but they haven't wholly gone. It's like watching a sort of an ancient building from the air. You know, the walls may be covered up by grass, but you can see the outline of the palace from a helicopter. You may not be able to see it when you're walking in the field, but you can see it high above, and I think that's how it is for me now.
Peter Stothard, early on, you visit the town of Capua. This is where the gladiatorial training camp from where Spartacus and about 70 other slaves escaped. Did you encounter any tangible reminders of that time?
Yeah, you can. You can look at, I mean, there's certain things, the landscape and the vegetation and your sense of how people might have felt about, for instance, Spartacus. I mean, Spartacus is shown to us as a good guy, you know. He was fighting for other people's freedom. He was against the big, bad, nasty Roman slave owners. You know, that's been the kind of view of Spartacus since the 18th century, pretty much. But for the Romans, of course, he wasn't like that at all.
I mean,
it was the most terrifying thing.
He sowed terror in the hearts of Romans. You write, his army took prodigious quantities of revenge in death, rape, and drink.
Yeah, and I know that's not the kind of Kurt Gundlach idea, but the truth of this story, well, obviously there are many truths to this story. I'm not saying it's the only way to look at it, but if you're on the road and if you're seeing it through Roman eyes, through the eyes of the people who are living there, and you go to their little houses and their little shops, that is, some of them are still being excavated in Capua, you see the guys struggling to make a living. Okay, they had slaves, they might not be considered good guys today, but these were guys desperately trying to make something of their lives, and slavery was part of their lives, and then suddenly these people who are part of your life, they were in the kitchen, in the bedroom, in the libraries, they kind of rise up, and it's a peculiar kind of terror. Clearly, in my mind, it did associate with the notion of a kind of a cancerous attack from within.
After leading a rebellion for 2 years, eventually Spartacus is defeated by Crassus. He's killed in battle. Crassus decides that all of the rebels who survived should be publicly crucified along the Via Appia, that ancient Roman road. 6,000 of them are crucified. It meant every 40 yards there was another rebel crucified, and you walked along that path. What was that like?
This was a pretty spectacular death show. The Romans wanted to get rid of the idea of Spartacus, but you know, before they forgot about him, they wanted to make sure one thing was remembered, which is that slave rebellions were an extremely bad thing which should be discouraged in the absolutely most extreme way. And in that, they were astonishingly successful.
Peter Stothard, what do you think you were hoping to find on this journey?
I think I wanted to understand my whole engagement with the thing which had meant most to me in my life, which was the engagement with Greek and Latin that had come to me very young. I was not attempting to answer questions about Roman history. This is not history in the library, you know, going through documents. This is understanding how we understand our past, in my case, a particularly brutal and dramatic way, which has made Spartacus Road the book that it is.
That's Peter Stothard talking about his new book, Spartacus Road, A Journey Through Ancient Italy. He's also the editor of the Times Literary Supplement. Peter Stothard, thank you so much.
Thank you.